Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, Monday morning. The big story this morning, of course, is Sears declaring bankruptcy. Let's go to CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, is there a lesson here, or is this just the natural life cycle of a big business?
I think there are a number of lessons here. With this bankruptcy, we learn that managing a big retail operation takes foresight. You can't just live in the today. You really have to look at what's happening. And, you know, an interesting thing about Sears is that this is, you know, obviously a more than 100-year-old company that was iconic, and it really controlled an enormous amount of the retail landscape at its height. It is said to have, at the very tip top, I believe that's the 50s or 60s, that 2% of the U.S. GDP went through a Sears catalog or store sale. That said, you know, in the 80s, it started to over-diversify. It started buying things like Dean Witter Reynolds. It was, I remember, they used to say they're going from socks to stocks. And that was a big diversification try that failed. And at the time when they were starting to accumulate, Dean Witter or the real estate firm Coldwell Banker or launching the Discover card, they were taking their eye off the ball. And you had a company called Walmart that was creeping up in the 80s. And Sears just did not believe that discounting like Walmart was going to do was going to be the path forward. And in 1991, Walmart was able to overtake Sears as the biggest retailer. And then essentially in the 90s, they were starting to cut workers and closing stores. And really in the next phase, it's called the late 90s and the early 2000s, we saw the decline of suburban shopping malls, the rise of online retail. And then in 2004-05, when the company turned to a financial engineering strategy rather than a marketing strategy or a business strategy, it was all downhill from there. We had big private equity investors coming in, buying the company, using any positive cash flow to buy back stock and enrich their own pockets at the expense of the brand.
So it sounds like just a series of bad decisions and failure to move fast enough.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this is a company that really needed to reinvest in itself. And when you look at, you know, just look at this, its most recent iteration, right, where Sears and Kmart were combined and then brought to the market with a lot of debt saddled on top of it, Sears invested just $4 billion in capital expenditures between 2006 and 2017. It's like less than 1% of their revenue during that time. And, you know, their competitors like Target and Macy's spent four times that. So we really, you see a period here where, you know, this was a company that did generate profits in the beginning. And, you know, when I go to the beginning, I mean, from when the private equity investors took over. But the private equity investors used the available cash to buy back the stock. They didn't invest in upgrading their facilities or making store improvements or enhancing technology or adding staff or advertising or adding to inventory. So,
Jill, is there a penalty for that, for an executive who does that kind of thing? I mean, the people who lose, of course, in a bankruptcy case tend to be the line employees who are just following orders. But the people who made those lousy decisions and enriched themselves, do they ever pay a cost when a company like this flops?
I mean, you know, not really. And the cost right now is that Eddie Lampert, who is the CEO and the mastermind of all of this, you know, big deal, he's stepping down. And he's lost billions of dollars of his own money. I guess that's okay, but he's left with billions more. I think that it is a good lesson. This and the Toys R Us story are good lessons about what private equity can and can't do for a company's future. And this is something that, you know, maybe in the moment where it seems like you have a lifeline, be very careful with whom you do that deal.
You listed three possible reactions to the big stock drop last week. Let's just go over them one at a time. For people who say, I'm freaked out and I can't sleep, what should they do?
Well, I mean, if you are freaked out and you really can't sleep, it probably means that you came into last week with a little bit more risk than you meant to have. And you can change your allocation, but But you've got to be very clear that if you're going to change your allocation and say, oh, wait, I messed up, I should not have done that. If that's the case, then what you really need to do is to make sure that you don't change your allocation again when the market turns around. That's the big trap we fall into. So if you can't sleep, you have too much money at risk, okay, change the allocation, but don't just second guess yourself again when the market ultimately returns to its loftier levels.
Next reaction, I need cash in the next 12 months. What do I do?
You made a mistake, I'm sorry to say. And the mistake is essentially that you were never to have any money that you needed within a year at risk in the first place. So if you need that money within a year, take it out of the stock market, whether it goes up a million points today or down to zero, take it out and make sure it's safe because you know you're going to need that money.
And then finally, people who don't need money for at least 5 years.
Relax. Stick to your game plan. And even people who are retiring, maybe if you're retiring tomorrow, if you're 67 years old and you're retiring tomorrow, you're probably going to live for 20 more years. So don't be so quick to get out. It is important to maintain your allocation, maintain that diversification. And hey, if you are still contributing to your retirement account, you're buying on sale. You love buying on sale. You know you do. Why do you hate it at this point in time? It's good. It's on sale. Relax.
How come I always feel so much better after talking to you?
I'm a shrink.
Which is what some people's nest eggs have been doing, too. But that's okay. That's okay. CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Great to be with you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. You hear all sorts of things about cholesterol, ranging from it's really horrible for you to the brain is made of it, so it must be pretty good. So let's consult the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. You know, Dr. Cohen, from time to time I listen to overnight radio, and I heard a guest by the name of Dr. Joel Wallach. He was talking to a guy who was having some kind of tremors. And so here's the diet that he recommended for this guy.
Let's see here. What do you weigh?
172.
172 pounds. I'd have you eat 9 eggs a day. I do want you to eat a stick of butter a day.
Stick of butter a day. And he went on to say that the reason he would say that is because your brain is made of cholesterol. So let's tackle what the current state of knowledge is on cholesterol. And first of all, whether this advice makes any sense to you.
So I usually don't like to do this, but this Dr. Wallach is really not a credible guy. He really, when he's on the radio, is primarily selling his own products. He himself is actually a veterinarian who then later went to naturopathic school. And he believes that all diseases are due to mineral deficiencies and that everyone who dies of natural causes dies because of mineral deficiencies. And that anyone who maintains their appropriate balance of minerals can live to 100 years or more. And this is just not accurate. There is no medical literature to support that. Importantly, if you look online at his stuff, he has to start every one of his videos by saying, quote, these statements have not been reviewed or approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. So I think anytime something starts with that kind of a disclaimer, you should be aware.
Okay, so cholesterol, though, is an essential component of good health, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So cholesterol is a molecule. It's actually a type of fat, and it's actually synthesized by all animal cells. Where do we get cholesterol from in our diet? You only get it from things that are animal, and you don't get it from plants. It's actually a complicated process that the body goes through, or animals go through. In the human body, it's a 37-step process to synthesize cholesterol. But importantly, the majority of cholesterol that's in our body comes from our own synthesis of it, and our body efficiently recycles it. So it goes through a process of metabolism through the liver. It's excreted in our bile, and 95% of it is reabsorbed through the small intestine back into our circulation. It's a precursor for all the steroid hormones in our body, and it's also a precursor for bile acids, as I just mentioned. It's also a precursor for vitamin D, which is important for us as well. But it also plays important roles in our brain in terms of protecting the brain and in terms of how certain neurotransmitters, the chemicals in our brain that cause signals to occur, how they're transmitted from cell to cell or neuron to neuron. So it plays many, many, many different roles in our body. So it is a very important substance.
Now to be clear, when you say the cholesterol is a precursor for this and for that, is it getting to those particular sites by traveling through the blood, or is it being manufactured locally?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, the majority of it is being manufactured locally, but some is coming through the blood. But 25% of the cholesterol in our body is actually found in our brain. And there's something called the blood-brain barrier, so that if you eat cholesterol and it's absorbed into your bloodstream and it circulates, it can't actually cross the blood-brain barrier to get into your brain. So it's not dietary cholesterol that's affecting your brain. It's, in fact, your brain is synthesizing and making it itself, and that's largely determined by your genetics. So there's cholesterol that circulates in our blood that is synthesized by our body, and then there's some that's affected by our diet, and then there's some that's produced in our brain. 25% of our overall cholesterol in our body is produced by our brain and remains in the brain.
So the flaw in the logic here seems to be that just because the brain is 25% cholesterol doesn't mean you need to take that much in, because it's manufacturing the cholesterol it needs.
Exactly. And there's been some confusing research that's come out about the amount of cholesterol in your brain as well, and the effect that it has on your cognition, your likelihood of developing dementia later in life. In fact, there's even been a study that was published recently that links the risk of suicide to your cholesterol level. And people who have lower cholesterol levels apparently have a higher risk of suicide. Now, it's only a very small increase, but it's something that has been statistically determined to be the case. Whether it's true and real or true and unrelated, nobody really knows for sure. This is just an observation, a relational study that's been done to this point in time. But the point is that there's conflicting information about what cholesterol in the brain might or might not do and its relationship to various different diseases.
There are some people who think there's also a link between cholesterol and Alzheimer's disease. What do we know about that?
Yeah, that's not our current understanding. Our current understanding is that the brain is synthesizing its own cholesterol, that it's genetically determined, and that you're not really affecting it by consuming it in your diet. The interaction that occurs in the brain is complex, and we don't fully understand the relationship between brain function and cholesterol. Everything in moderation, right? That's always going to be the best advice. There are risks to having your cholesterol too low. There are risks to having your cholesterol too high. The guidelines that have been established for the most part are really those that are appropriate because they establish moderation.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Election Day, just over 3 weeks away, and Washington voters will have a lot to vote on, including four statewide initiatives. Among them is I-1634, better known by its nickname, Yes on Affordable Groceries. You might ask, who's out there trying to make groceries unaffordable? That's why we've called in Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Yeah.
Dave, if you see the I-1634 commercials, you'll think it's about stopping the spread of some looming grocery tax. But as opponents of this initiative point out, it's already illegal for local governments to tax groceries like fruits, vegetables, milk, and bread in our state. So they say this campaign is really only about stopping the spread of Seattle's recently passed sugary beverage or soda tax. The Yes campaign here has raised $13 million. Almost all of that is from soda companies. That's compared to just under $8,000 from the No campaign, which is supported by health advocates. Another major supporter of this initiative, labor groups. Pete Lamb is with Teamsters Local 174, and among those campaigning for I-1634, he tells KTTH's Jason Rance this is about protecting jobs.
The reality of it is that this initiative protects beverages and food. So from our labor perspective, you know, every time you go to the grocery store, basically every item you put in your grocery cart is something that's either picked, loaded, or delivered by a Teamster. And so these are really good jobs, and we think that it is lunacy to impact and potentially decrease the number of good-paying jobs in the state of Washington. We need more of them. I think we all can agree on that, not less.
Now, as for what this initiative will do if it actually passes,
that local governments cannot impose taxes on food or grocery items. So counties and cities could not impose taxes like this. It can still come up in the legislature. The legislature could still propose or vote in a tax there. But we think that, you know, if this is passed overwhelmingly and the polls are showing strong support for it, we think that it sends a very clear message not only to local communities and municipalities, but also to the state legislature as well.
So this would not repeal Seattle's soda tax then?
No, it would not repeal Seattle's soda tax, but it would keep it from going any higher. So they wouldn't be allowed to raise it, and it would keep any other city or county in the state from enacting its own soda tax or sugary beverage tax. Now, Seattle's 1.75 cents announced tax was sold as a way to discourage people from drinking soda, and it kicked in January. And in the first 6 months of the year, it brought in well over what it was expected, some $10 million. Now, critics call this a regressive tax, and one backer of I-1634 says they want to keep it from spreading statewide, as we've discussed. But Vic Holman, who's with the Washington Healthy Kids Coalition, or the No campaign here, tells Cairo 7 this is about a more important issue.
It may be a regressive tool to do the tax, but it's a progressive public health policy.
Now, that remains to be seen here. There's no solid data on what the outcome or result has been from Seattle's tax, aside from that over $10 million that it's brought in, as far as whether it's discouraged people from drinking sodas. A report on that is due out next week.
I remember when I first saw the impact of this tax, I decided that the soda was just too expensive, but I didn't go out empty-handed. I bought the seltzer water, you know,
right,
which I assume was also delivered by a truck. I mean, is there any indication that if people change from a sugary beverage to a non-sugary beverage, that there will be fewer truck drivers delivering stuff to grocery stores?
I mean, that's the way labor would tell you. I don't know that I have a solid answer on that, but they seem to think so. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me that that would be the outcome, but it remains to be seen.
Yeah. So this has been tried in other cities, right? Do we know what the impact has been, either in terms of accomplishing the goal, which is to, you know, have kids drinking less sugar, or has it killed businesses?
So I know in Berkeley, which I think is where they did this first, back in 2014, they did an initial analysis on this that found that, I want to say, consumption of sugary beverages went down about 10%, or sales dropped about 10%. But overall beverage sales did not. So that suggested that it did have that goal of that positive health outcome. And I think in Philadelphia or Pennsylvania somewhere, they've also done something similar that also seemed to indicate very loosely, because I think theirs is only a year old, too, that it was having that kind of positive impact. But it's fairly new results.
Yeah. And of course, if you want a tax-free sugary beverage, you can just go outside the city limits and buy it.
And that's another concern. And some people here in Seattle have said that, especially when we're talking about the right on the line of a jurisdiction where, like, say you're in White Center, there is no sugary tax. And then so people that live here might just cross the border. And I think they've seen that in other cities that have enacted these.
But and trucks have to deliver those beverages too, right? So the additional sugary beverages going into White Center could be driven by truck drivers.
They would be driven by truck drivers, yes.
Are you allowed to smuggle untaxed sugary beverages across the city line?
I don't know.
I do every day by drinking a Diet Coke while driving.
Yeah.
I bring mine in. I live in a different jurisdiction, so I bring my own stuff in.
So I'm working with a couple of smugglers here. Huh?
No.
Okay.
I plead the fifth.
Bootleggers.
Yeah.
That's us.
Bootleg soda. Thank you.
You bet.
When they start brewing it in bathtubs, then we'll start worrying. Here he is, direct from 710 ESPN, Danny O'Neill. You know, if a game can be too exciting, I'd say the Husky Ducks game qualified for that. I was I had butterflies the whole time, and you got to explain to me that that last play, the last play in regulation, the field goal. Huskies could have won it on the field goal. 3 seconds left. They had let the clock wind down, and then the other team calls a timeout as he's running up to the ball
twice. There's a technique for it. It's called icing the kicker.
Now, why is that okay?
Because
why is that allowed?
They've got the timeouts. You can use it. Put as much pressure as you can on the opposing team.
But the guys run. I mean, because he ended up kicking the ball 3 times because they called the timeout after he started his run, right?
That's correct. But everybody knows. I actually think the better tactic would be to be a coach and have everybody think you're going to ice the kicker and then not ice the kicker, because then they'd have to snap it. And actually, the play would be for real. But yeah, no, that's allowed. Up until the ball's snapped, you're allowed to call timeout.
Huh.
Icing the kicker. Shifting the pressure onto the player.
So ends up kicking it 3 times. First one's bad. Second one's good, but another one counts. And then the third one is bad.
That's correct.
And that's the one that counts.
And
they go into overtime.
If you replay it, that's where you can hear my cry of anguish echo across the entire city of Seattle. It sounded something like, ah!
I heard that up in Snohomish County.
So you think it's okay. By the way, Chris,
they do it all the time. I mean,
Chris,
icing the kicker is just a
Chris
part
is full
of the
duck
deal.
This morning.
It's totally okay.
Yeah. Icing the kicker is totally okay.
You guys have been very gracious on Twitter, Danny, in your column.
It was a hell of a ball game.
Last week, you guys were at each other's throats, and now I'm just seeing.
Well, because
calm...
I can't look at it.
He can't look at me. I don't gloat. That's what I don't do. I'm happy, and I'm wearing an outfit today that is kind of giving a little bit to you.
But ah!
Because next year it could change. I mean, 70 points on your home field 2 years ago, it sucked. Yeah, but you have to win with class and lose with grace. I've given up being the guy that throws it around. Even on Twitter, or I just stayed off it, except I said bow down to nothing, I think, on Twitter, because
oh,
I'm so tired. I was so tired of it.
That's not provocative.
No, not at all. But, yeah, it is what it is. Next year could be totally different. I feel terrible for the kicker. I feel terrible for that kid.
I feel bad for the kicker, too. I feel bad for myself as well, because my little heart is broken. Aren't you guys worried about me?
Oh, yeah. You've been very subdued this morning. Right. You're not looking at Sully.
It's not like I went and wrote a song last week about what sort of dense hicks all the Oregonians were. So I'm not sure why all these people keep coming back to look at me. It was a good game, and it's part of the. There are different levels of defeat, and I'm going to term this the blunt trauma version. Like where you just feel something and you come away from it, and this is what you ask. It's not like, how did the game go wrong? What are all the different things? You're like, why do I care so much? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why do I care about this thing that is giving me so much pain?
See?
Football is stupid.
Exactly.
Why do I care about football?
Give it up.
We care because it makes you feel alive.
Stop using your phone, too.
And that was as excited as I've been when Washington was driving into Oregon territory twice in the fourth quarter. Mm-hmm. You're dancing around by yourself and all of the different excitement. You feel alive and then just poof.
Oof,
all your dreams,
forced trauma,
up in smoke.
Don't worry, you can get Schadenfreude back next week when I'm sure the Oregon letdown at loss leads to a loss in Pullman.
It's possible. It's possible that I'm going to go to Pullman and root for the Cougs.
Really?
No, that would be, well, yeah, I will be rooting for the Cougs no matter where I'll be, but I might be in Pullman
for
doing
game
it.
Day. Isn't that amazing?
That's
finally,
right. Because if the Cougs win, Washington once again has control of its own destiny in the
really?
Pac-12. Mm. That's correct. So we'll be Coug fans this week. So if that's the blunt trauma game. Yesterday was the parade.
All right. Yeah.
That was the parade, the Seattle Seahawks. There's no uncertainty about it.
Right.
Everything happens just like how you want it to.
Exactly.
You get to see all the little floats that you want. Oh, look, there's the first round pick. Rashad Penny is actually kind of doing something.
And the 12s dominated Wembley.
Yeah. Oh, the fans, they came by too, and we get to celebrate
more games
them.
In London.
And Russell Wilson, he was so phenomenal. It's a parade, and everybody gets, there was candy canes thrown off or some sort of hard candy that people, no, that's just part of the parade. Do you ever go to the parade and just want the candy?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah. That's the candy was thrown out in this parade, too, because everybody got to see. We even got to watch Marshawn, and, oh, he still looks good, but he wasn't so good that we lost.
That's right.
It was the happiest day for Seahawks
fans. And I like your
fans.
Conclusion is that the what did you say in your column? You said the Seahawks aren't bad. We don't know if they're good yet, but they aren't bad.
That's totally correct. There are one quarter of the teams in the NFL, exactly one quarter of the teams who are awful, and they will, right about now, you know they've got no shot at making the playoffs. They'll sometimes beat each other. Maybe they'll upset somebody, but they're going to finish somewhere between 1 and 7 wins this season, and we know they're inconsequential. The Seahawks are not one of those teams. They're not. We don't know if they're good and going to make the playoffs, but they're not a bad team.
Right.
All I can say is it was easier to enjoy my snacks during the Seahawks game than during the Husky game. Sorry, I didn't mean to bring it up again. But thank you, Danny.
Talk to you soon.
We have a padded room where you can scream to your heart's content.
And the Beverly Hillbilly song plays over and over and over there. Which, by the way, I got to admit, was an awesome, some of Danny's best work ever, even though it made fun of the team that my dad played football for.
I can say that no president in my lifetime has been psychoanalyzed as much as our current president has, and that's actually against the policy of the American Psychiatric Association. They have warned doctors that they should not be trying to diagnose somebody, even a president, at a distance. But that has not stopped Dr. Justin Frank from writing and releasing and talking about his latest book, Trump on the Couch, Inside the Mind of a President. He is a political professor of psychiatry at George Washington Medical Center. He's also done similar profiles of Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and he argues, as you would expect, Donald Trump's childhood shaped his life, and that some of the traits cemented in those early years are playing out every day in his presidency.
He really felt, even from an early age, that whatever he wanted to do, he could do. So, for instance, he was essentially, he nearly lost his mother when his little brother was born because she almost died during the birth. And at that point, Donald was two. So he never actually, and when she came home after a few months of being away in the hospital, he really didn't have anybody to help contain him or having a strong maternal force. So over the years, he had to provide his own maternal force, which was he had to love himself, he had to become grandiose, he compensated, he felt he could do whatever he wanted, and he could do no wrong. And so because of all those things, he evolved into a very self-centered, self-involved person who didn't really have empathy. He could mock others. He didn't respect women. And then in order to manage any anxiety, he would divide his inner world up into good and bad. And never the twain shall meet. So everything is either good or bad. There's no such thing as a little bit of bad mixed with the good. And because of that, everybody does that to some extent. We all do that when we're 5, 6, 7 years old. But he has continued to do that. So he sees fake news. He sees people who criticize him as enemies. He has never accepted blame. If you divide your world like that, you can never take blame for anything you do. So he's had a long history of blaming others, denying responsibility, and being, shall we say, grandiose.
You also describe him as a pathological liar.
Yes.
And where do you feel that came from?
Well, that came from also a form of lying to himself. Everybody lies to themselves a little bit. We all do. Because he had trouble reading as a kid, because he had a trouble learning as a kid, because he had trouble understanding what other people said, he would make things up as if they were fact. And so he developed a way of making things up to manage his anxiety, to avoid facing the truth about who he was, and to avoid facing any kind of painful reality.
So you're saying he really can't help himself. The lies, yes, are sort of built in?
The lies are built in. One of the things that happens is because of the way he has evolved over the years, anything that is criticism is experienced as fake. So anything that's news or anything about him that's being criticized, he denies and he converts it into something fake. He lies about facts. He lies about experiences. He exaggerates things. He even called it in one of his books a truthful hyperbole, which you could say, well, that's what salesmen do. But just the word hyperbole is really about a lie. But he has to preserve an ideal self that he had to construct in order to manage a tyrannical father and an unavailable mother. So he became this ideal self-contained person. And part of the lie that he tells himself is that he's self-reliant. He doesn't need anybody. He walks out and makes a grand appearance on the stage. His biggest self-deception, it turns out, was that he believed that he really was the person he was playing on The Apprentice, when actually that person who kept saying you're fired was a person who was reading from a script.
Okay, so let me just rise to his defense here for a moment. That may be a reason not to invite him over for dinner, because nobody wants a bore, right? But he is now working in a job which puts him in touch with a bunch of other world leaders who probably share a lot of these very same characteristics. So maybe in a perverse kind of way, that helps him hold his own with other like personalities.
I think that it does help him hold his own. And I think it's good that you're rising to his defense, because there are qualities in his nature that are really strong, that I admire, and that I feel are genuine. He does hold his own. In fact, I think when he was calling Kim a little rocket man last year, I don't think he meant that he was going to blow up North Korea, but he blusters and threatens in a way that's very effective. And that's how he does business. He bullies, he accuses people of things. And I think that other world leaders are similar. The difference is that in the UN, the other world leaders are comfortable being interdependent. They're comfortable realizing that they can't go it alone. That's why there's a United Nations in the first place. He does not like United Nations. He does not like treaties. He does not like other people. He feels that everybody's out to get him, and he always thinks that the United States is being taken advantage of by different countries, like Canada or Mexico. It's a constant feeling he has. So I think that on the one hand, he is like other leaders because he's got a strong sense, but he also has no concept of interdependence. He's withdrawn from every treaty. He can only do things one-on-one. He can't work with a group. He doesn't know how.
He would say, though, that nobody has brought North Korea as close to denuclearization as he has. Nobody has dared face down China the way that he has. He also intends to do a deal in the Middle East because he sees it and thinks he's perfectly positioned to do that because he sees it as a real estate deal, which he understands. So do you see any way that these qualities that you find in which are so negative could, in fact, help him become a successful president, or are you predicting that this is going to end in catastrophe?
I don't know. I actually think that some of his qualities are very useful. He's clearly comfortable being aggressive, being assertive. He's like the kind of person who is like a living version of road rage writ large. He does it in broad daylight. I think that he might be a successful president.
Dr. Justin Frank, political professor of psychiatry at George Washington Medical Center and author of Trump on the Couch and Obama on the Couch and Bush on the Couch. It's a crowded couch.